Chapter 4. Bob Firestone never felt guilty about what happened to Harry because of that Weisskopf business. As he saw it, Harry himself was to blame for being so naive. What a yutz, he thought. Ruined his own life. Bob had moved on, graduating from strike-breaking to the more lucrative business of labor racketeering. By 1935, he was a player in the Building Service Employees Union, whose latest target was the Bryce Building. "Listen, I'll organize the sandwich men. You guys handle the delivery end," said John McGee, a fellow organizer whom Bob had known since they were small-time bootleggers. "I've already got the boards. They say, join the custodians and janitors union now," said Bob. "That's a start," put in Don Campbell. "Bob, you and I need to talk to them janitors to make sure they know what's good for them. They join us or they're out. Simple as that." "Yeah, okay. I'll get some of our guys to make sure nothing goes in or out of the building without our say-so. They want their ice or food. They want heat. I wish them luck. They'll join up or it's a no-go. They can freeze and starve. See how long it takes," laughed Bob. Bob and Don loitered near building entrances, walking close enough to custodial workers to intimidate them into joining the union. The sandwich men paced in a circle holding the placards. Bob knew it was really the management they were after. Most workers liked unions, but their bosses were probably pressuring them not to join. Bob, McGee, and Campbell managed to stop all deliveries in or out of the Bryce Building, trying to shut the place down till the bosses caved in. The cops cited Bob and his cohorts for contempt since they were violating an injunction against picketing. John McGee claimed the sandwich men were advertising, not picketing, so they didn't do anything wrong. Bob and Campbell went to court. McGee made sure not to show up. "We don't have a lawyer, Your Honor," said Bob to the judge. "Can we wait till we have a lawyer?" "Not gonna happen, Mr. Firestone, unless I get a commitment from you or Mr. Campbell that the sandwich men will stop what they're doing and there'll be no further problems moving goods and services into and out of that building," replied the judge, an older man with a grizzled jaw and a no-nonsense glare. "I can only speak for the men here with me today, Your Honor. My colleague, Mr. McGee, hired the sandwich men. He's not here today. He's the one who has to tell them to stop." "Then I guess you're out of luck, Mr. Firestone. You have one day to get yourself an attorney and bring Mr. McGee in here." Bob sat back down on the hard bench in the small wood-paneled courtroom. Don Campbell, sitting beside him, whispered, "I think we should call Corrigan. He's done right by us before. I'll give him a call as soon as we leave here." Attorney Brian Corrigan agreed to take the case and was there when Bob, McGee, and Campbell appeared in the courtroom the next day. "I've thoroughly reviewed the case before the court today, despite having less than 24 hours to do so. With all due respect, Your Honor, it is my considered opinion that you may be biased against my clients," declared Corrigan, a dapper-looking gentleman in a conservative suit and monochromatic tie. He swiped at his mustache after he finished speaking, as if to show he had had the last word. "Frankly, I'm not interested in your opinion. If you have a problem with me, you can go through the proper channels. Right now, I have a problem with your clients. I will not issue a continuance until these gentlemen promise the sandwich men are gone and will stay that way," the judge retorted loudly, while pointing a finger at Bob and his fellow defendants. Under his breath, Bob cursed Elliot Ness for the thousandth time. Things had become a lot harder ever since that sanctimonious grandstanding gumshoe had shown up the year before. Riding high in his reputation as the man who supposedly brought down Capone, Ness had convinced the city fathers to make him Cleveland's public safety commissioner. Then he'd gone on a rampage against the rackets and bent cops alike. Now everyone was so afraid of Ness that you couldn't even rely on cops and judges to stay bought. Worse yet, Frank Milano, boss of the Mayfield Road Mob, had fled to Mexico to avoid a tax evasion indictment that Ness had helped cook up. Bob had tried to steer clear of the fighting that broke out as several different guys battled to seize the vacant throne, but got sucked in anyway. Before Al Polizzi finally emerged as the winner, someone had tossed a bomb into the glazed right premises. It blew out all the windows and damaged the foundation. Bob had told the cops and the papers that it was surely a case of mistaken identity. Bob rebuilt Glaze Right and got a bigger piece of the action by winning the trust of Al Ruddy, a loyal Polizzi lieutenant who was head of the Carpenters Union. By 1940, he was running the Janitors Union for the Mayfield Road mob. Yet just when everything seemed to be going so well, Ness was ruining it. He'd put Jaime Barrington, the Carpenters Union boss in West Cleveland, away for labor racketeering, and now the word was that Jaime had agreed to rat out Al for extortion, bombing a laundry, and even murder. If Barrington hadn't turned informer, why had Ness moved him from the London prison farm to cushy digs in the Mount Vernon Tuberculosis Sanitarium? As far as any of the Mayfield boys could recall, Jaime wasn't a lunger. Since Barrington had never met him, Bob got the job of putting the squeeze on the rat. He started by paying a visit to Jaime's wife one bright, cool Monday morning. Bob, dressed in a conservative suit, shirt, and tie, trying to look like a professional man, dignified and responsible, but he knew in his heart that he probably wasn't going to pull it off. When Jaime's wife opened the door of their suburban home, Bob said, "Good morning, Mrs. Barrington. My name is Frank. I'm a friend of your husband's." "Hello, my husband isn't here. I'll tell him you were here, Mr. Frank. Do you have a last name? What's all this about?" "May I come in, Mrs. Barrington? I hate to talk out here on the street where everyone can listen to our business." "Business? I'm not sure I understand. I don't know you, and I was just about to run out to the store," she said. Bob thought she was getting scared now, but was trying to sound cheerful and unafraid. She was an apple of a woman, short and round, with red hair and pink cheeks. Bob noticed she wasn't wearing a hat or a coat. He didn't think she was just about to run out to the store. "Well, I won't keep you," answered Bob, content to stand outside the front door if that was what Mrs. Barrington wanted. He could already sense that she wasn't falling for his act, and the last thing he needed was for her to start screaming or running off. He took a quick look around. It was the middle of the day. Fortunately, he didn't see anyone on the street. "Tell your husband Frank stop by. I know where he is and why he's there. Certain people haven't been treating Jaime right, but they've been called in and told what to do. You know, it'd be too bad if Jaime talked. We're a far-reaching outfit with men from coast to coast. Jaime will never live in Cleveland if he talks." Bob spoke quickly, opening his suit jacket to reveal a New York label. "I'm not sure what you mean," said Mrs. Barrington, glancing around her as she tried to move away from her door to be closer to the street. "Sure you do. Listen, I'll make this plain. You won't have to pay for those trips to visit Jaime at Mount Vernon anymore, and he'll live like a king while he's there. All you have to do is convince your hubby to keep his mouth shut about Albert Ruddy. You tell him Frank said so, and you mustn't try to see anyone without Jaime's permission." He finished in a low, sinister. Later in court, Mrs. Barrington would testify that Bob told her he'd be back, but he never returned. Bob was certain that he'd frightened Jaime's wife, but couldn't be certain that it had the desired effect on the man himself. To be sure, Bob made several trips to visit Barrington at Mount Vernon, always introducing himself as Frank Sanchetta. He offered Barrington $6,000 to escape prison and flee to Mexico, and made dire predictions about what would happen if he didn't. Unfortunately, Jaime was just as dubious about Frank as his wife had been. The guy didn't look very Italian and didn't sound much like a New Yorker. And for all his tough talk, Frank seemed uncomfortable and uncertain. After each visit, Barrington couldn't help but think, "This guy's trying to sound like a big shot, but if he thinks I'm falling for it, he's got another thing coming." Ness quickly figured out Frank's real identity, and in October 1940, had Bob arrested for trying to induce Barrington to escape. Ness had a personal interest in the case. He had a particular dislike for labor racketeers, and Firestone was among the worst. He corrupted everything he touched, skimming union dues, stealing from the pension fund, and strong-arming management. I'm going to get this guy. I've got to take him down, Ness decided. After his arrest, Bob decided to skip his mandatory appearance before a county judge. He told his attorney, Jay McDevitt, to tell the judge, Mr. Firestone can be reached any time by the Cleveland police. Why isn't he here today in my courtroom, then? Asked the judge, whose sharp nose could have cut paper. I can't comment on his absence today, Your Honor. Well then, Mr. McDevitt, your client will be held over for the grand jury on a $5,000 bond. The gavel nearly cracked. When Bob finally showed up in court, he offered to take a lie detector test to prove his innocence. The prosecutor rejected the offer. Bob whined, I'm not guilty, Your Honor. The morning sun shone directly in his face, causing a squint that didn't help. I visited Jaime in prison, but I never asked him to escape, and I've never threatened anyone. Surely you have more important things on your mind, Your Honor, continued Bob. I do. I have an appointment with the draft board to get my physical. I'm supposed to be there tomorrow. McDevitt, wearing a silver sharkskin suit, pleaded with the jury. Do you want to rob him of the opportunity to fight for the colors? Haven't you heard? Hitler's conquered France. Mr. Firestone is ready to serve his country in the nation's first peacetime draft. He's an honorable man. Your request is denied, said the judge in a flat voice, rolling his eyes. He instructed the attorneys to proceed with the case. Bob listened from the defendant's table. Barrington was sworn in. I never tried to escape because I respected the people who sent me to prison more than I was concerned about any bribe. The judge rolled his eyes once more. When I rejected Mr. Sanchetta's bribe, he threatened me, said Barrington, using Bob's unconvincing pseudonym. He started listing names of Clevelanders who had been shot or killed. He said I'd better not squeal on Albert Ruddy, John McGee, or Don Campbell. When it was his turn to testify, Bob explained. Mr. Ruddy received a telegram from Mr. Barrington. He figured formal language was more believable. I happened to see Mr. Ruddy in the barbershop. He told me the telegram was hard to read and asked me if I could go visit Mr. Barrington to clarify what he wrote. So I did, simple as that. I visited Mr. Barrington twice. Where was Mr. Ruddy while you were visiting Mr. Barrington? Asked the prosecuting attorney. He was in a hotel room near Mount Vernon, said Bob, taking a puff of his cigar. Ness asked the judge to have the telegram read aloud to the jury. It said if Ruddy didn't get Barrington paroled, he was prepared to testify against him. The judge knew Ness had it in for Firestone and feared that if he let the racketeer off, Ness would turn his sights on him. Ness had made his name going after crooked cops and lawyers, judges, too. The prosecution rested because its next witness was not present in the courtroom. It was Isaac Gross, the same guy Bob tried to bribe 10 years earlier to prevent contractors from using other glazing companies. Ness personally traveled to New York to locate Gross. Once there, he sent a message to the judge explaining that Mr. Gross apparently left his home in New York the previous day and was nowhere to be found. He had not been in touch with his family or staff. Ness wrote, I'll stay in New York to find out what happened to him. I hope to have him in your courtroom soon. I expect Gross to testify that he remembers being threatened by Bob if he testified against Glazing Company co-operator Don Campbell before Campbell was sent to the Ohio pen for extortion. When Isaac Gross appeared in court, there was no explanation for his previous absence, but Ness, also back in the courtroom, explained that several labor people had pressured Gross not to leave New York. When he heard this, Bob became very angry. He denied everything. He had not visited Gross or offered him money, and he had not warned him against testifying in the current trial. Furthermore, he denied creating a monopoly through Glazerite and the Glazers Union. He maintained Campbell, McGee, and union officials had no financial interest in the firm. Bob's strident denials made no impression on the judge or jury, who both seemed more impressed by Barrington's testimony. He told me he'd give me $3,000 if I didn't go to the Campbell trial. Bob gave me his real phone number and address. He said, when you finally make up your mind not to testify, give me a call and we'll take care of you. What happened then? Asked the prosecutor. I didn't need to testify because Campbell pled guilty, answered Gross. In September 1941, Jaime Barrington was paroled after serving as the star witness in the racketeering cases against Bob Firestone and Albert Ruddy. The jury spent 2.5 hours considering the charges against Bob before convicting him. The jury foreman told the press that Mr. Gross's testimony was the deciding factor, since it was a question of who was the biggest liar, where Bob and Jaime were concerned. Bob got a 3 to 15 year sentence, but was freed on a $5,000 bail to allow time to rule on a motion for a new trial. Ruddy was sentenced to 4 to 20 years in the Ohio Penitentiary for labor racketeering.